Welcome to a podcast for everyone. Practical conversations answering your questions about how to make websites and mobile apps work for everyone. This podcast series is brought to you by UIE's All You Can Learn, Rosenfeld Media, the Passiello Group, and O'Reilly. Today, Whitney Quisenberry will be talking to Francis Harris about assistive technology.
Well, hi everyone. I'm Whitney Quisenberry, and I'm co-author with Sarah Horton of A Web for Everyone. Today I'm talking to Frances Harris. She's a medical anthropologist whose research focuses on people with disabilities. She's part of an amazing team at CATIA, that's the Center for Assistive Technology and Environmental Access at Georgia Tech. Hey Frances, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, it's my pleasure.
Lovely to talk to you. We have so much to talk about, but I want to start by asking you about what it means to be someone with anthropological training in the work you do.
Well, unlike traditional anthropologists whose methodology has historically relied on participant observation, I think I work more as a qualitative researcher, which is a term that was coined, I think, back in the 80s to distinguish researchers from quantitative researchers. And it differs from anthropology, which is more grounded in theory and history. Qualitative research borrows research techniques from a variety of social scientists, including anthropology. As an anthropologist working in disability, I do mostly semi-structured and open-ended interviews. The research questions of a particular project tend to guide the development of an interview script. And I think the anthropology side of my research is in my interest in context, the social context, the economic and political. I don't always get to use that data during an analysis, especially when I'm involved in a quantitative study. But it can set the stage for thinking about meaning, for example, what voting or disability has for different people and how they live their experiences as a person with disability or as a voter in the context of family, social relationship, works, politics, etc.
Do you think that it makes a difference when you're interviewing someone that you're in their context?
You mean in-person interviewing? Oh, yes.
Not just in-person. Do you think it makes a difference when you're interviewing someone, not just that you're talking to them face-to-face, but that you're actually going places to where they live or work?
Oh, yes. That is closer to a traditional methodology of anthropologists called participant observation. I think when you're doing interviews, you're getting to know somebody, the quality of the data you get is really only as good as your ability to establish a relationship with them. And that's much easier if you're face-to-face or if you're actually in the place where they are and observing and talking to them in the context of the activities of their daily life or the activities that you actually want to examine.
So you're getting more information than just what they say.
Yes, because one of the great things about participant observation is you can observe the differences between what people say they do and what they, in fact, can be observed doing. I don't mean to say that there's some dissemblance or deceptiveness going on, but people's meanings change. There can be a discrepancy between verbal reports and observed behavior for a lot of reasons. People may be a little fearful because of social or legal consequences. Memory is selective. People can repress certain aspects of their behavior that they may be embarrassed or reluctant to talk about.
Well, I had a really good example of that recently. We were working with people who use screen readers and watching them try to use a website. And there were people who were very experienced with their tools and people who were new to their tools. And one of the women, it was a little painful watching her work because she really was still learning the tool and she was had to work very slowly. And at the end of it, we were all like, oh, I felt like I'd been mean to her by making her do all this work. And she said, isn't it wonderful that I can do this myself?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because her vision was going. She could see to navigate around the screen, but not see well enough to read. And so she had this mix of, you know, navigating with the mouse, but also using the screen reader to read to her. And to her, she had been a professional. She was losing her ability to read the screen. She thought her days of computing were over. And so her attitude was completely different than ours watching her.
Right. It's very interesting to see the complexity of people's social lives. It's difficult to envision, let alone to articulate what those complexities are. So the observer will see one thing and the person may be experiencing quite a different thing. And that meaning is so important. It's sort of the heart of anthropology and most social science research.
So the meaning is kind of in the intersection of this outside observer and the inside perceptions.
Yes. In one sense it is, yes.
So how did you get involved in working with people with disabilities as part of your study?
Actually, it's kind of weird. I was an English major in college for most of my college life, and I took a survey course in anthropology and was instantly smitten and changed my major at the spot. But I got my PhD pretty late in life, and I wasn't sure what to do with it. So I read an ad in a paper that said we were looking for a research assistant to work with people who use assistive technologies at an acute rehab hospital here in New York. And I didn't even know what assistive technology was, and I knew very little about disability, which was very undeveloped in anthropology at that time. And so they hired an anthropologist to work on a quantitative study. I had never taken statistics before and knew very little about it. But while I was doing the study, they were intrigued by the idea of an anthropologist, and I was allowed to do some interviews. And those actually helped the quantitative part of the study. And from then on, I couldn't stop reading about disability.
So tell me about some of the projects you work on at CATIA these days.
Well, one of the projects that we're working on, or that I have worked on and still am, is looking at how people who use wheelchairs part-time and use other mobility devices, how they integrate them into their everyday life. Clinicians very often have to prescribe multiple technologies, and sometimes they don't use their wheelchairs. And one of the reasons, they wanted to explore what those reasons were. So I've been interviewing people at the VA in North Carolina who live in very different kinds of circumstances, and how they will use a walker, when and why, and switch to a cane, and then when do they use their wheelchair. And this information is designed for clinicians, basically, to help them prescribe mobility devices with greater accuracy and give them the best care they can. I'm also working on a project that is looking at the universal design practices in workplaces. And we're developing two surveys, one for people with employees to look at their sense of inclusion and participation in the workplace. And another survey is being developed for the employers or supervisors. And we're trying to look at the relationship between accommodations, providing accommodations to a person with a disability, which is the more traditional way of addressing disability in the workplace, and the usefulness of universal design principles.
So let me unpick this a little bit. Give me an example of an accommodation.
An accommodation might be a screen reader. It could be a voice-activated computer device that would help somebody who didn't have the use of their hands. It could be an adjustable table that would allow a wheelchair to scoot underneath it. It's usually in the form of a device, but it can also be an adjusted work schedule. It can be allowing someone to do telework from home on certain days. It's that kind. And what it is, it's an individual accommodation instead of creating an environment where everybody can work.
So this is something that's done specially for one person as opposed to something that applies to everyone.
Yes.
And so give me an example of how one of those might be changed into a universal design approach.
Well, for example, for wheelchair users, hallways could be wide enough. Desks could be at adjustable heights. Doorways can be wide enough. Accessibility into a workplace, you know, the parking areas and being able to maneuver into a building can be done so that they can enter the building with every other employee. The idea is to create a seamless environment so that there's a little distinction between people with disabilities and people without disabilities.
Okay. So like if you have an adjustable height desk, that's fine at your desk, but it means you can't work at the conference table.
Exactly.
Okay. So I met you a few years ago. We're going to indulge a little bit of my obsession with elections. And I met you a few years ago when you did this really great study of the voting experience for people with disabilities. And full disclosure, I actually was the coordinator for this grant from the Elections Assistance Commission. One of the reasons I was so excited about this project was that most of the work trying to understand the voting experience of people with disabilities has been done quantitatively through surveys and looking at census and actually data. But your study was one of the few that really looked more deeply at the actual experience. Voting is such a private activity. How did you do the study?
Well, we recruited people from a number of places. We wanted to get a very wide range of voters with disabilities, all different disability types from mobility to vision to hearing. So we started recruiting from the CATIA Consumer Network at CATIA, which is a listserv or a roster of about 1,000 people with disabilities who would like to participate in research. We also posted invitations to participate on community and disability listservs and also independent living centers. And we used both interviews and observations, and that was an especially fun study to do because we did get to observe as well as to interview. And we did those during the 2011 and 2012 elections.
So what did you do, go to the polling place with people?
Yes, a researcher would either meet a subject, a voter, at the polling place, or they would travel with them, and the voter would vote. The researcher was not allowed to assist, but they observed the voter's interaction with voting machines, with poll workers, with the entire election polling place process, and then directly afterwards, they were interviewed about their experiences, which was very helpful.
And what did you learn?
Well, we learned a great deal. We interviewed about 50 people, and when we looked at the data, we acquired a tremendous amount of data. We found three basic categories that people were concerned about and addressed in the interviews and in the observation and interviews. One was the social environment of polling places, and that was dominated chiefly by poll workers. And we looked at the facilitators and barriers, what made it easier for people to participate in the voting process and what hindered them. And sometimes the facilitators and the barriers were the same. For example, friendliness and courtesy was considered to be a great facilitator. And the knowledge about voting procedures and technologies was also considered to be a great facilitator. At the same time, that the lack of knowledge about voting procedures and technologies was also cited as a chief barrier. A second theme that emerged was pre-election information about ballot issues, the location of polling sites, registration procedures, and how to use the voting machines. The primary barriers included difficulty finding information on candidates, the accessibility of the precincts and the voting machines, and inconsistent information. They would get information from one source and from another source. And the importance of the pre-election information was one of the things that made some voters want to vote absentee as opposed to going to the polling place. A third theme that emerged was the physical environment of the polling places. And I think this has been addressed probably more often in the literature. People looked at the architectural and community factors, the accessibility of the polling place, its location compared to their home. Was there sufficient space inside the polling place? Adequate signage and posters? Were voting booths set at the right position for somebody with a wheelchair? Those kinds of things. And the level of detail about the physical environment was, well, it was a very detailed list of things that could act, everything from audio output to adequate and adjustable font size. As I said, the physical environment addressed not just people with mobility disabilities, but vision, hearing, cognitive manipulation. When we also analyzed the data, we found, it's very interesting, we found four major themes that emerged from the interviews and observation. One was the importance of a sense of inclusion in the voting process. Most of the people that we interviewed felt a strong civic responsibility to vote, and they also viewed it as one way for their voice to be heard and to change some of the political attitudes towards people with disabilities. The other key thing was privacy and independence. And all of these are interconnected. Privacy, independence, and stigma were the last three themes.
One of the questions I always wonder about, and I'd love to ask you, is how does what you learn by a deep dive into something like voting give you insights into broader daily experiences that we could use for other kinds of products we might be working on?
Well, I think elections are an extension of many of the challenges of daily life for people with disabilities. And to my knowledge, there's been little anthropological attention paid to them. Just like every other aspect, whether it's people's work lives or family lives, elections and daily activities reflect people's attitudes and vice versa. This is how the meaning is created. For example, privacy can have very different and sometimes contested meanings in voting, for example. The location of voting booths was somewhat contentious and interpreted differently. One voter liked it when voting machines were segregated from voting machines for people without disabilities because it gave her a quiet, and that sense of isolation gave her more time in a more quiet and peaceful environment to vote in. Somebody else felt like her vote, like she felt that she was being segregated from other voters and that she was being excluded, and she was concerned that her vote would not be counted. So the same sort of accommodation to a person with a disability can play out very different. Their meanings and the interpretation and their attitudes can vary.
So one of the things I'm hearing is that we should be very careful not to treat people with disabilities as though they're one big user group that has all the same attitudes.
Exactly. Privacy, independence are all very important themes, but they can be interpreted quite differently.
You know, the other thing that I noticed, I was talking to someone about a project who'd worked on making bank machines accessible. And they said, one of the things that's interesting is that it's not like people with disabilities didn't have cash before. They had a way to get cash. And it takes a while for them to transition to using a new solution because they need time to check it out, trust that it's going to be better than what they've been doing before. So it's not just making it accessible at all. It's making it a better experience than what you had before.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Yeah.
I want to turn to some practical questions because I know that the whole question of doing more ethnographic research is a really hot topic in UX these days. But often I think people don't know how to get started. And I wanted to start by picking up on something you said about the voting project, which is that you talked to 50 people. That's a huge number of people.
Yes. Well, we had a staff of 6. It wasn't just me. Mm-hmm.
So you split that up among other people, because I think one of the kind of assumptions about ethnographic work is that it's very small numbers. What I'm hearing is that it doesn't have to be.
No. If you have a large research staff, you can follow and interview and observe many, many more people. And if it's over a period of time, you know, if you have a year or two to spend with people, you can observe many more people. I mean, when people go into the field to do participant observation in a city or on a reservation, you're usually observing and interviewing many, many people over that period of time.
So is this something that, I mean, let's say you ran a UX department for a, you know, a big product. Is this something that you could do a little bit at a time over a longer period of time and just wrap it into all your other work?
That's interesting. Yes, I think that would be possible. I think there needs to be a certain continuity, but that continuity doesn't have to be in terms of every day. I think if you're in a place, in a business place where, you know, it's a large population and you have other things to do, yes, you can integrate it. But you would still need to focus on those questions specific to that project.
Right. So if UX researchers want to include people with disabilities in their research, I think one of the things that everybody worries about is how do you get started? Do you have practical advice, tips about recruiting or effective working styles that you can help people with?
Okay. First of all, recruit from as many places as you can. Disability organizations, hospitals, independent living centers, colleges, and you can also use a technique called snowball sampling, which is you ask the people that you're interviewing or doing research with if they know somebody else who might be willing to talk. One of the reasons you want to do this is that many people who volunteer for research projects have a heightened consciousness and want to do something to improve their lives and the lives of others with disabilities. And this is great, but you also need to find people who are more isolated and hidden, hard to find. They provide a greater range of information and insights than people who have a more heightened consciousness. And another reason you want to have a very wide range of subjects, as wide a range as you possibly can, is to establish a working relationship with subjects. As a matter of fact, the word subjects is slightly contentious right now. I use that term in quantitative research, but in qualitative research, it's not such a great term to use. Subjects reflects an inherently passive role in a research project. Researchers administer questionnaires that are designed by the research. They analyze results, and they do lots of things that confirm the expertise of the researcher. But in reality, subjects are the experts. They have the knowledge that we want to understand and use. And the question I think that researchers and designers need to ask themselves is, how do we find out what they know? It's as much an attitude towards research and people, and it has implications for how we define our research goals.
Yeah, I was about to say, it sounds like a big shift in your attitude about your research. It sort of shifts from the I'm the person in the white coat, you know, doing studying things, to I'm engaging with people as I work with them.
Exactly. There's something called, I don't know how familiar people are, something called participatory action research, which is a research approach that became increasingly popular within disability studies. It looks at the researcher-subject relationship, and unlike the traditional research model, which pretty much renders a subject as a passive object of study, participatory action research proposes a collaborative relationship between the researcher and the subject. When it's applied as a strategy, it really challenges researchers to adapt and incorporate subjects' voices into their study design and methods. When you're looking at, for example, designing, I think, end-user research products, I think it's useful to incorporate people with disabilities, their views, their identification of research questions and problems and goals right from the beginning. The research should be collaborative and iterative throughout the entire process. They can be included in developing the methods. You can do this through focus groups, through interviewing, and in project meetings, so that their voices are consistently being heard throughout the process.
So what you're saying is that it's not just that you sit back in your office and you think up a research question and then you think about how you're going to do it, but you actually build the research question through research.
Right. And that requires a working relationship with the people that supposedly you want to study or develop something for. Yeah.
I'm sitting here looking at a sign in my office, a poster that says design with, not for. That
yes.
comes out of the civic design movement. But I know one of the early mantras of the disability rights movement was nothing about us without us.
Yes, absolutely. And that is, I mean, people with disabilities have been studied by medical and healthcare workers for many, many years. And the field of rehabilitation looks at disability primarily as a health and medical and functional problem. But disability is also defined socially.
Let me do it as an analogy. If I was working on a mobile device, a mobile app, for instance, I might be interested in, you know, how someone manipulates the device. You know, what do they click on? What do they tap on? How do they use it? But I also might be interested in when, where, and why they use it. And that's much harder to do by hauling someone into a research room and asking them questions. And you get a much richer picture if you actually watch them using it. You know, you're hanging out with them at the mall and you see when they pull their phone out to do something.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think that there were some early studies on how people use computers, and observers went into the home and found out that computers were not being used just by individuals, but by families and all at once. And that changed how computers were marketed, from what I understand. This is early on.
So let's think about one of the things that we've said a lot is that we need to sort of build relationships. I know that a lot of UX research is done by recruiting through, you know, ads in newspapers or mailing lists and so on. But I'm hearing you say that you need to, in order to do this deeper research, you need to get a little deeper. That is, you need to actually find the Independent Living Center and maybe go down and meet them and put in a little groundwork up front to build a relationship with the community.
Yes, I think that's absolutely essential, both from just pure social science research, but also for designing. Watching people work or do something in the context of their everyday activities is critical to understanding what they really want, what they're really using it for, and what they need, how to make it better.
Is there a middle ground? One of the suggestions that I've heard is that instead of bringing people to your office or to your research lab, that you could go someplace, like if you could go to the Lighthouse for the Blind, which has social centers, or you could go to an independent living center, and you're still not quite in their home environment, but you're in an environment where they're comfortable. And does that make a difference?
Oh, completely. As I said, you need to establish a relationship with people, and part of that is making them comfortable. As a researcher, you're not going to be able to establish a great relationship with everybody, but one of the things you can do is to take them out for a cup of coffee or offer to meet them in a place that they're the most comfortable in, and allow them also to guide the conversation to a degree. I mean, you're coming in as a researcher, a designer with certain goals, but they have things they want to tell you. And one of the most important things about establishing that relationship is learning how to listen. Well, for example, in the voting project, when I was interviewing poll workers at one time, they would say, oh, we don't have any people with disabilities come to our polling place. And that's because they were thinking of disability as a wheelchair, as somebody in a wheelchair, or somebody with a white cane. But then you would get them talking and you would find out there was somebody there with a hearing aid or somebody who had recently come back from Afghanistan who was jumpy. And these are the kinds of issues that you get when you establish a relationship and get people talking.
Yeah, I think one of the things that scares a lot of people about working with people with disabilities in their research is that they're afraid they'll say something wrong or insult somebody or just be hapless. Any tips?
First of all, there is a disability etiquette. There's plenty of information about that on the internet, but I wouldn't worry about that. I think people with disabilities value, from what they've told me, the effort to be courteous, that they may make a mistake, but I think they've seen it all and they've done it all. And they appreciate the effort to be kind and courteous, even if they make a specific mistake.
So be human.
Yes, be human. Be kind. Offer help, just as you would to anybody. Don't be afraid of making a mistake.
Does it get easier?
To not make a mistake? Yes, because people will tell you. I think intuitively, when I first started talking to people who used wheelchairs all the time, I would sit down, and I later found out that that was considered something courteous. But then I would watch people occasionally touch somebody's wheelchair, and you could see that it was as if somebody had touched their head or some part of their body. And you realize that that was a no-no after a while.
Okay. So you can think about what reactions you get and build on those.
Yes.
You talked about how many different kinds of disability there are and how many different kinds of people with disabilities you've worked with. Do you have to adjust your research plan or, you know, how you actually conduct the research to accommodate different kinds of disability? How do we factor that in?
I did a research project looking at how teleconferencing equipment was used for business meetings by people with cognitive disabilities. And what was interesting is that we used teleconferencing as the basis for how we conducted the focus group. So you were able to have people articulate why and their reactions and the problems they were having using the equipment as you were actually asking them about what context they used teleconferencing and why they liked it and disliked it. I've worked mostly with people with mobility impairments. I have not worked with anybody with vision or hearing impairments, but I have worked with mobility and cognitive. And there is an overlap. With people with cognitive disabilities, I think there's patience, giving people time to process information in different ways. Yes, there are different ways of approaching, I would say, research with different types of disabilities. Yeah.
So just as you need to approach each participant as a person, you need to sort of adjust your own personal style to meet them?
Yes, absolutely. And cognitive disabilities, for example, is a huge category. It can cover everything from autism to how people process knowledge, dyslexia. And it's useful if you have a sense about what their issues are. But otherwise, again, it's just a matter of being patient and giving people time and asking them what they need. That's another thing. We shouldn't be afraid to ask people what they want or what's the best way to approach this research or this is what you want to do. And
after all, you're hauling them in there to ask them a whole bunch of questions anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So what makes them the most comfortable?
Well, we've been talking a lot about how you do your work and why an anthropological approach or an ethnographic approach is so useful. Can you give me an example of how a designer might take all this information and where it might lead them in their design process?
I think it allows a designer of research to see the unintended impact or meaning a device or behavior or product may have in different contexts. You can observe how an idea can change or morph into an unintended use. And I think there's an expression that's always been important to me. It was coined by William Gibson, who's sort of the elder statesman of cyberpunk. He wrote that the street has its own uses for things. And I think one of the most obvious examples is the internet itself. The internet was originally conceived as a network for researchers to exchange scientific information. And instead, it's become this rapid communications medium and a means of establishing non-geographical communities. It contained a lot of exploitable niches, you know, that are still being developed, but which were unintended by its original developers.
So you can see hints of that. You can look at how somebody has done something just for themselves and think, wow, this is something that could be a broader product.
Exactly. You know, the point is when you're observing a person's behavior or interviewing them, you need to anticipate myriad ways in which an activity or device can be made useful or meaningful to a person.
That is a great way to end. So thank you so much for joining us, Frances. This was a wonderful conversation.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
And to our listeners, we'll be posting links to any of the projects or resources that we've discussed today. You can find them on the A Podcast for Everyone page on Rosenfeld Media and in the UIE All You Can Learn library. And thanks to you for listening in, and a special thanks to our sponsors. That's UIE, Rosenfeld Media, the Paciello Group, and O'Reilly for making this series happen. Be sure to follow us at A Web for Everyone on Twitter for information about future podcasts.
Thanks for joining us for A Podcast for Everyone. This series is a companion to the book A Web for Everyone, co-authored by Sarah Horton and Whitney Quisenberry. Be sure to tell us what you want to learn next at awebforeveryone@gmail.com. This podcast series is brought to you by UIE's All You Can Learn. UIE's All You Can Learn will give you the skills and techniques you need for a competitive design advantage with 24/7 access to UX experts and topics. Rosenfeld Media. Rosenfeld Media offers unequaled UX expertise in print and in person. Their experts consult, teach, and write books like A Web for Everyone. The Paciello Group. The Paciello Group helps organizations make their technology accessible to everyone, including people with disabilities. As always, thanks for listening.